Random House Audio presents South of Broad by Pat Conroy. Read for you by Mark Deakins. Prologue. The Mansion on the River. It was my father who called the city the Mansion on the River. He was talking about Charleston, South Carolina, and he was a native son, peacock proud of a town so pretty. It makes your eyes ache with pleasure just to walk down its spellbinding narrow streets. Charleston was my father's ministry, his hobby horse, his quiet obsession, and the great love of his life. His bloodstream lit up my own with a passion for the city that I've never lost nor ever will. I'm Charleston born and bred. The city's two rivers, the Ashley and the Cooper, have flooded and shaped all the days of my life on this storied peninsula. I carry the delicate porcelain beauty of Charleston like the hinged shell of some soft-tissued mollusk. My soul is peninsula-shaped and sun-hardened and river-swollen. The high tides of the city flood my consciousness each day, subject to the whims and harmonies of full moons rising out of the Atlantic. I grow calm when I see the ranks of palmetto trees pulling guard duty on the banks of Colonial Lake, or hear the bells of St. Michael's calling cadence in the cicada-filled trees along Meeting Street. Deep in my bones, I knew early that I was one of those incorrigible creatures known as Charlestonians. It comes to me as a surprising form of knowledge that my time in the city is more vocation than gift. It is my destiny, not my choice. I consider it a high privilege to be a native of one of the loveliest American cities, not a high-kicking, glossy, or lipsticked city, not a city with bells on its fingers or brightly painted toenails, but a ruffled, low-slung city, understated and tolerant of nothing mismade or ostentatious. Though Charleston feels a seersuckered, tuxedoed view of itself, it approves of restraint far more than vainglory. As a boy, in my own backyard, I could catch a basket of blue crabs, a string of flounder, a dozen redfish, or a net full of white shrimp. All this I could do in a city enchanting enough to charm cobras out of baskets, one so corniced and filigreed and elaborate that it leaves strangers awed and natives self-satisfied. In its shadows you can find metalwork as delicate as lace and spiral staircases as elaborate as yachts. In the secrecy of its gardens you can discover jasmine and camellias and hundreds of other plants that look embroidered and stolen from the Garden of Eden for the sheer love of richness and the joy of stealing from the gods. In its kitchens, the stoves are lit up in happiness as the lamb is marinating in red wine sauce, vinaigrette is prepared for the salad, crab meat is anointed with sherry, custards are baked in the oven, and buttermilk biscuits cool on the counter. Because of its devotional, graceful attraction to food and gardens and architecture, Charleston stands for all the principles that make living well both a civic virtue and a standard. It is a rapturous, defining place to grow up. Everything I reveal to you now will be Charleston-shaped and Charleston-governed, and sometimes even Charleston-ruined. But it is my fault, and not the city's, that it came close to destroying me. Not everyone responds to beauty in the same way. Though Charleston can do much, it can't always improve on the strangeness of human behavior. But Charleston has a high tolerance for eccentricity and bemusement. There is a tastefulness in its gentility that comes from the knowledge that Charleston is a permanent dimple in the understated skyline, while the rest of us are only visitors. My father was an immensely gifted science teacher who could make the beach at Sullivan's Island seem like a laboratory created for his own pleasures and devices. He could pick up a starfish or describe the last excruciating moments of an oyster's life on a flat 100 yards from where we stood. He made Christmas ornaments out of the bracelet-like egg casings of whelks. In my mother's gardens, he would show me where the ladybug disguised her eggs beneath the leaves of basil and arugula. In the Congaree swamp, he discovered a new species of salamander that was named in his honor. There was no butterfly that drifted into our life he could not identify by sight. At night, he would take my brother, Steve, and I out into the boat to the middle of Charleston Harbor and make us memorize the constellations. He treated the stars as though they were love songs written to him by God. With such reverence, he would point out Canis Major, the hound of Orion, the hunter, or Cygnus, the swan, or Andromeda, the chained lady, or Cassiopeia, the lady in the chair. My father turned the heavens into a fresh puzzlement of stars. Ah, look at Jupiter tonight, and red Mars, and isn't Venus fresh on her throne? A stargazer of the first order, he squealed with pleasure on the moonless nights when the stars winked at him in some mysterious, soul-stirring graffiti of ballet-footed light. He would clap his hands with irresistible joy on a cloudless night when he made every star in the sky a silver dollar in his pocket. He was more North Star than Father. His curiosity about the earth ennobled his every waking moment. His earth was billion-footed, with unseen worlds in every drop of water and every seedling and every blade of grass. The earth was so generous. It was this same earth that he prayed to because it was his synonym for God. My mother is also a Charlestonian, but her personality strikes far darker harmonies than my father's did. She is God-haunted and pious in a city with enough church spires to have earned the name of the Holy City. She is a scholar of prodigious gifts, who once wrote a critique of Richard Ellman's biography of James Joyce for the New York Review of Books. For most of my life, she was a high school principal, and her house felt something like the hallway of a well-run school. Among her students, she could run a fine line between fear and respect. There was not much horseplay or lollygagging about in one of Dr. Lindsay King's schools. I knew kids who were afraid of me just because she was my mother. She almost never wears makeup other than lipstick. Besides her wedding band, the only jewelry she owns is the string of pearls my father bought her for their honeymoon. Singularly, without artifice or guile, my mother's world seemed disconsolate and tragic before she really knew how tragic life could be. Once she learned that no life could avoid the consequences of tragedy, she softened into an ascetic's acknowledgement of the illusory nature of life. She became a true believer in the rude awakening. My older brother, Steve, was her favorite by far, but that seemed only natural to everyone, including me. Steve was blonde and athletic and charismatic and had a natural way about him that appealed to the higher instincts of adults. He could make my mother howl with laughter by telling her a story of one of his teachers or about something he had read in a book. I could not have made my mother smile if I had exchanged arm farts with the Pope in the Sistine Chapel. Because I hero-worshipped Steve, it never occurred to me to be jealous of him. He was both solicitous and protective of me. My natural shyness brought out an instinctive championing of me. The world of children terrified me, and I found it perilous as soon as I was exposed to it. Steve cleared a path for me until he died. Now, looking back, I think the family suffered a collective nervous breakdown after we buried Steve. His sudden, inexplicable death sent me reeling into a downward spiral that would take me many years to fight my way out of and then back into the light. My bashfulness turned to morbidity. My alarm systems all froze up inside me. I went directly from a fearful childhood to a hopeless one without skipping a beat. It was not just the wordless awfulness of losing a brother that unmoored me, but the realization that I had never bothered to make any other friends. Rather had satisfied myself by being absorbed into that wisecracking circle of girls and boys who found my brother so delicious that his tag-along brother was at least acceptable. After Steve's death, that circle abandoned me before the flowers at his graveside had withered. Like Steve, they were bright and flashy children, and I always felt something like a toadstool placed outside the watchfires of their mysteries and attractions. So I began the Great Drift when Steve left my family forever. I found myself thoroughly unable to fulfill my enhanced duties as an only child. I could not take a step without incurring my mother's helpless wrath over my raw un-Stevenness, her contempt for my not being blonde and acrobatic and a Charleston boy to watch. It never occurred to me that my mother could hold against me my unfitness to transfer myself into the child she had relished and lost. For years I sank into the unclear depths of myself, and learned with some surprise that their haunted explorations would both thrill and alarm me for the rest of my life. A measurable touch of madness was enough to send my fragile boyhood down the river, and it took some hard labor to get things right again. I could always feel a flinty, unconquerable spirit staring out of the mangroves and the impenetrable rainforests inside me. A spirit who waited with a mineral patience for that day I was to claim myself back because of my own fierce need of survival. In the worst of times, there was something that lived in isolation and commitment that would come at my bidding and stand beside me, shoulder to shoulder, when I decided to face the world on my own terms. I turned out to be a late bloomer, which I long regretted. My parents suffered needlessly because it took me so long to find my way to a place at their table. But I sighted the early signs of my recovery long before they did. My mother had given up on me at such an early age that a comeback was something she no longer even prayed for in her wildest dreams. Yet, in my anonymous and underachieving high school career, I laid the foundation for a strong finish, without my mother noticing that I was, at last, up to some good. I had built an impregnable castle of solitude for myself, and then set out to bring that castle down, no matter how serious the collateral damage or who might get hurt. I was 18 years old, and did not have a friend my own age. There wasn't a boy in Charleston who would think about inviting me to a party, or to come out to spend the weekend at his family's beach house. I planned for all that to change. I had decided to become the most interesting boy to ever grow up in Charleston, and I revealed this secret to my parents. Outside my house, in the languid summer air of my 18th year, I climbed the magnolia tree nearest to the Ashley River with the agility that constant practice had granted me. From its highest branches, I surveyed my city as it lay simmering in the hot-blooded saps of June while the sun began to set, reddening the vest of cirrus clouds that had gathered along the western horizon. In the other direction, I saw the city of rooftops and columns and gables that was my native land. What I had just promised my parents, I wanted very much for them and for myself. Yet I also wanted it for Charleston. I desired to turn myself into a worthy townsman of such a many-storied city. Charleston has its own heartbeat and fingerprint, its own mugshots and photo ops and police lineups. It is a city of contrivance, of blueprints, devotion to pattern that is like a bent knee to the nature of beauty itself. I could feel my destiny forming in the leaves high above the city. Like Charleston, I had my alleyways that were dead ends and led to nowhere, but mansions were forming like jewels in my bloodstream. Looking down, I studied the layout of my city, the one that had taught me all the lures of attractiveness, yet made me suspicious of the showy or the makeshift. I turned to the stars and was about to make a bad throw of the dice and try to predict the future, but stopped myself in time. A boy stopped in time, in a city of amber-colored life that possessed the glamour forbidden to a lesser angel. Part 1. Chapter 1. June 16, 1969. Nothing happens by accident. I learned this the hard way, long before I knew that the hard way was the only path to true, certain knowledge. Early in my life, I came to fear the power of strange conveyances. Though I thought I always chose the safest path, I found myself powerless to avoid the small treacheries of fate. Because I was a timid boy, I grew up fearful and knew deep in my heart the world was out to get me. Before the summer of my senior year in high school, the real life I was always meant to lead lay coiled and ready to spring in the hot Charleston days that followed. On June 16, 1969, a series of unrelated events occurred. I discovered that my mother once had been a Roman Catholic nun in the Sacred Heart Order. An Atlas moving van backed into the driveway of a 19th-century Charleston single house across the street from ours. Two orphans arrived at the gates of St. Jude's Orphanage behind the cathedral on Broad Street. And the News and Courier recorded that a drug bust had taken place on East Bay Street at the Rutledge Bennett House. I was 18, with a reputation as a slow starter, so I could not feel the tectonic shift in my fate as my history began to launch of its own volition. It would be many years before I learned that your fate could scuttle up behind you, touch you with its bloody claws, and when you turn to face the worst, you find it disguised in all innocence and camouflaged as a moving van, an orphanage, and a drug bust south of Broad. If I knew then what I have come to learn, I would never have made a batch of cookies for the new family across the street, never uttered a single word to the orphans, and never introduced myself to the two students who were kicked out of Porter Gard School and quickly enrolled at my own Peninsula High for their senior year. But fate comes at you cat-footed, unavoidable, and bloodthirsty. The moment you are born, your death is foretold by your newly minted cells, as your mother holds you up, then hands you to your father, who gently tickles the stomach where the cancer will one day form, studies the eyes where melanoma's dark signature is already written along the optic nerve, touches the back where the liver will one day house the cirrhosis, feels the bloodstream that will sweeten itself into diabetes, admires the shape of the head where the brain will fall to the axe handle of stroke, or listens to your heart, which, exhausted by the fearful ways and humiliations and indecencies of life, will explode in your chest like a light going out in the world. Death lives in each one of us and begins its countdown on our birthdays and makes its rough entrance at the last hour and the perfect time. I awoke at 4:30 that June morning, threw on my clothes, then rode my bike to the northeast corner of Colonial Lake, where a News and Courier truck was idling in the darkness, waiting for my arrival. I began folding a huge pile of papers and placing them tightly wrapped with rubber bands into one of two capacious bags that hung from my shoulders. It took 15 minutes for me to get the bike right for the morning run, but I was fast and efficient at what I did. I had been a newspaper boy for 3 years. In the light of the truck, I watched Eugene Haverford writing down the addresses of new customers or complaints from one of my regulars. Already, he was on his second Swisher Sweet cigar of the morning, and I could smell the Four Roses bourbon on his breath. He thought the cigar smoke masked his early morning drinking.
"Hey, Leo, my distinguished Charleston gentleman friend,"
Mr. Haverford said, his voice as slow as his movements. "Hey, Mr. Haverford.
Got two new subscriptions for you. One on Gibbs Street, one on South Battery."
He handed me two notes printed out in large letters.
"One complaint, that lunatic on Legree Street claims that she has not gotten her newspaper all week."
"I hand-delivered it to her, Mr. Haverford. She's getting forgetful."
"Push her down a flight of stairs for both of us. She's the only customer to ever complain about you."
"She gets afraid living in that big house," I said. "She's going to need some help soon."
"How in the hell do you know that, Charleston gentleman?"
"I pay attention to my customers," I said. "Part of the job."
"We bring the news of the world to their front doors, don't we, Charleston gentlemen?"
"Every day of the year, sir."
"Your parole officer called me again," he said. "I told her what I always tell her, that you're the best newspaper boy I've seen in my 30 years with the company. I tell her the News and Courier is lucky to have you."
"Thanks," I said. "I go off probation soon. She won't bother you much longer."
"Your old lady made her weekly pain-in-the-ass call, too," he said.
"Mother'll probably call you the rest of her life."
"Not after what I told her yesterday. You're 18, Leo. A man, as far as I'm concerned. Your mother's a stiff bitch. Not my kind of broad. But she asked me if you were fulfilling your duties properly. Her exact words, by the way. Listen up, Leo. Here's what I told her. If I ever have a kid, which I won't, I'd like him to be exactly like Leo King. I wouldn't change one thing. Not one thing. My exact words, by the way."
"That's so nice of you, Mr. Haverford."
"Quit being so naive, Leo. I keep telling you that. Quit being so open to the world shitting all over you."
"Yes, sir. My naive days are over."
"You goddamn Charleston gentleman."
With a squeaking of wheels, he drove off into the darkness, his cigar glowing like a firefly in his cab, and I pedaled my bicycle forward. Heading south on Rutledge Avenue, I lobbed a rolled-up newspaper on the first piazza of every house on the street, except for Burbage Elliott, who was famous as a tightwad even in penny-pinching Charleston. He borrowed his paper from Mrs. Wilson. She read it over her breakfast of soft-boiled egg, stone-ground grits, and chamomile tea, then recycled it to her stingy neighbor by tossing it onto his back porch. I could lob a newspaper with either hand. When I turned left on Trad Street, I looked like an ambitious acrobat hurling papers to my right and left as I made my way toward the Cooper River and the rising sun that began to finger the morning tides of the harbor, to dance along the spillways of palmetto fronds and water oaks until the street itself burst into the first flame of morning. The lawyer, Compson Brailsford, awaited me in his yard and got down in a wide receiver's stance as I neared the serene stillness of his family's mansion. As I passed, he sprinted out in his seersucker suit, elegant as a Swiss army knife, and ran a quick button-hook pattern in the trimmed grass. On the days when I was good, the paper was already in the air when he turned and made his move back toward the imaginary quarterback at the Citadel. He was an all-Southern Conference end. On this morning, his movements were letter-perfect and efficient, and my pass arrived at the precise moment. It was a game that had begun between us by accident, but it continued every day unless he was out of town or the weather too inclement for a well-dressed Charleston lawyer. The gardens of Charleston were mysteries walled away in ivied jewel boxes, emitting their special fragrances over high walls. The summer had proven good for the magnolias that had bloomed late. I passed one old 40-foot tree that looked as though 100 white doves had gathered there in search of mates. My sense of smell lit up as the temperature rose and the dew started to burn off the tea olive and the jasmine. My armpits moistened, and I began to offer my own scent back to the streets, where coffee began brewing in hidden kitchens, and the noise of the newspapers hitting the soft wood of the verandas sounded like mullets jumping for joy in giant lagoons. Turning right on Legree, I was hitting my stride. Moving fast down the center of the street, I arched my longest throw of the morning at the mansion behind the Sword Gate House, putting it on the third step. At the Ravenel House toward the end of the street, I made my first real misfire on what had been a morning of machine-like precision and hurled a paper into a mass of oversized camellias. I stopped the bike, skipped through the gate, retrieved the paper from the top branches, and sailed it up to the front door. The small, dark nose of a King Charles Spaniel named Virginia poked through the bottom of the fence across from the Ravenels, and I hurled a paper to the far corner of the yard, where the exquisitely tricolored dog retrieved it in a flash and carried it in triumph to its master's doormat. I followed that throw by tossing the small dog biscuit into the same yard, which Virginia would then walk down to retrieve with great dignity. When I'd taken the job 3 years earlier, all the arrayed stars of my life had been aberrant and off course. So I promised myself I would do this job well. If I heard of a customer rummaging around in the garden hunting for their morning paper, I always called to apologize. A good paper boy was a study in timeliness and steadfastness and accuracy, and that's what I wanted to bring to my customers. It was what Eugene Haverford had growled at me during my week of orientation. So there I was, a delivery boy, making my rounds in a city where beauty ambushed you at every turn of the wheel, rewarded every patient inspection, and entered your pores and bloodstream from every angle. These images could change the way the whole world felt. It was a city that shaped the architecture of my memories and dreaming, adding cornices and parapets and the arched glooms of Palladian windows every time I rode those streets, full of purpose and duty. I threw missile after missile of pages chock-full of news, as well as art show openings on King Street and sales taxes making their way through Senate committees in Columbia, a total eclipse of the sun due in the fall, and a terrific sale at Berlin's clothing store entering its last week. When I started the job, my life was at a standstill, my choices down to one, and my opportunities barren on the vine. From the day I took the job, I was watched over by the South Carolina Juvenile Court, a child psychiatrist connected to Roper Hospital, my worried and overarching mother, and a gruff hillbilly from a North Charleston trailer park, Eugene Haverford. I looked upon this paper route as a source of redemption, a last chance to salvage a childhood ruined by my own baffling character and one unspeakable tragedy. When my share of the world's cruelty struck, I was 9 years old. It would take a great portion of my time as an adult before I realized that tragedy was hurled freely into everyone's life, as though it were a cheap newspaper advertising porno shops and strip shows thrown into an overgrown yard. I was an old man by the time I turned 10 years old, and I caught the terrible drift of things many years before my number should have been called. But by age 17, I had come through the bad times intact and functioning, leaving friends behind in the impersonal mental wards of my state, whose eyes stayed opaque with a milky, nameless rage. I had loved the faces of the hopeless up close and held them trembling through hallucinations that never left them a minute's peace. Living among them, I discovered I was not one of them. Yet they hated me when they saw a calmness return to me years after I found my beloved older brother, his arteries severed, dead in the bathtub we both shared, my father's straight razor on the tiles of our bathroom floor. My screaming brought a neighbor running to the house through a first-story window and finding me, in hysterics, trying to pull my brother's lifeless body from the tub. A serene, uneventful childhood ended for me that night. When my parents returned from the Dock Street Theater, Steve's body lay in an unnatural peace in the downtown morgue. the police were trying to calm me down to question me. A doctor administered a sedative by injection, and my life among drugs and needles and psychological testing and shrinks and therapists and priests began. It was a time that I believe to this day ruined both my parents' lives. When I turned my bicycle left on Meeting Street, the sun was high enough on the horizon for me to cut off the bike lamp. Meeting was spacious and cocky, with mansions on both sides of the street, a showboat of a street, and a city brimful with them. Here I zigzagged from one side to the other, taking dead aim at front doors heavy and sumptuous enough to be the entrances to the residences of kings. The traffic was still light, and if my rhythm was true, I could service the length of the street all the way to Broad in 5 to 7 minutes. Taking a ride at Broad Street, I hit the doorways of a dozen lawyers' offices, sometimes 3 at a doorway, 4 at one, and 6 at the Darcy, Rutledge, and Sinclair law firm, the largest in the city. At Church and Broad, on the southeast corner, there were several fresh piles of newspapers waiting for me. I stopped to reload, not losing my rhythm while noticing the increasing traffic of ambulatory lawyers picking their way to favorite restaurants and cafes. The street began to smell of coffee and bacon frying on grills, and a slight wind from the harbor told of buoys and ship hulls brined by the tides and the years. The awakening of gulls followed the first freighter making the turn toward the Atlantic, and the bells of St. Michael's answered the puny, half-human cry of the gulls. Working fast, I loaded up with the last 100 newspapers of my route and blasted down Church Street, my arms whirling again in the eccentric morning dance of paperboys. Early on, I could feel the redemptive powers of hard work, and I basked in the praise of Mr. Haverford and my customers who lived on this island of the Peninsula City. My predecessor had been born to great privilege and lived in one of the houses I now served, but the hours proved too early for him and the labor too intrusive on his late-night social life. He was soon let go, not fired, because of his family connections that traced back to the actual founding of the colony. When the upper management of the News and Courier decided to take a chance on me, it was a nod of approval and gratitude to my parents' distinguished life as educators in the city, as well as a way to pull my entire family back from the brink after the death of my brother. Steve's death had wounded the city in some profound, inchoate way. I was granted the job not because of who I was, but because of who Steve had been. And what a boy Steve had been, I thought, as I took a ride on South Battery, bringing the sweet-smelling papers onto the steps of what I considered the prettiest row of mansions in the city. Steve would one day have lived in one of those houses, after marrying the most comely and glittering debutante in Charleston, after graduating from Harvard and coming back to South Carolina for law school. In my mind, Steve would always remain 18 months older than I would ever be, a natural leader known for his great wit and charm. Many people thought he would ripen into one of the best athletes ever raised in Charleston. In the summer, he turned into a new color of gold, his hair a shade of blonde that reminded one of the tawniness of Siamese cats. His eyes were bright blue and emotionless and almost textureless when you saw him sizing up a new person or situation. All of Charleston agreed that he was the last boy on earth who would take a razor to his arteries and fill up a bathtub with his own blood. He was so dazzling in both presentation and personality that the city could not come to terms with the violent self-hatred suggested by his death. On the other hand, I was exactly the melancholy, apprehensive kind of child, a Venus flytrap type of boy overshadowed by his rosy-cheeked, overachieving brother, who could commit such a terrible crime to himself and to the image the city had of itself. Ahead of me, I saw Miss Ophelia Sims watering her flower boxes in front of her house. Stopping the bicycle, I handed a newspaper to her. "How's that for service, Miss Sims?" "I should think it approaches perfection, Leo," she said. And how are we today? We are fine today. I was always thrilled that Miss Sims referred to me in the lordly plural. And how are our flowers today? A little peaked, she would always say during our rare encounters among her phlox and impatience. To me, Miss Sims was a knockout, and I knew that she had celebrated her 50th birthday that year. I hoped that I would one day marry a girl in her 20s, half as lovely as Miss Sims. But that probably was a long shot, and I was reminded of it every time I looked at myself in the mirror. Though I wouldn't call myself ugly, it wouldn't surprise me if I heard that someone else had said it. I blamed it on the black horn-rimmed glasses my mother had bought me, but I was so nearsighted that the lenses looked like they could have served as the portholes of ships. My eyes held a fish-like cast that those lenses managed to overemphasize and had been the butt of much teasing among my peers, unless my brother was around. Steve was overprotective of his baby brother as he hovered over me, patrolling the cruel airways above the school playground like a red-tailed hawk. Fearless and sharp-tongued, he let no one bully his little brother. Steve's obvious superiority caused me some discomfort and even resentment as a child, but his fierce championing and unwavering love of me made me feel special. My brother was so handsome that I could sense my own mother's disappointment every time she looked at me. Zigzagging through the smaller streets and alleys south abroad, I would finally reach the Coast Guard station and pause to rest for a minute or two. I could make this run blindfolded, and I also prided myself on hitting certain corners at the correct time. I always checked my watch to see how I was doing, panting from exertion and the good pain I felt in my thigh and arm muscles. Putting myself into high gear again, I pushed off with the sparkling Ashley River to my right, a river I could hear beating against a seawall on stormy nights near my house. The Ashley was the playground of my father's childhood, and the river's smell was the smell my mother opened the windows to inhale after her long labors, bearing my brother and then me. A freshwater river let mankind drink and be refreshed, but a saltwater river let it return to first things, to moonstruck tides, the rush of spawning fish, the love of language felt in the rhythm of the wasp-waisted swells, and a paperboy's hands covered with newsprint, thinking the Ashley was as pretty a river as ever a god could make. I would start the last sprint of my route, flinging papers with confidence and verve, serving the newer houses built in the filled-in corpses of saltwater marshes as I headed due east again. Running past White Point Gardens, I would turn north when I saw Fort Sumter in the distance, sitting like a leatherback turtle in the middle of Charleston Harbor. I would service the really big mansions on East Bay, then Rainbow Row, take a left at Broad and do both sides of the street, weaving through traffic and still more strolling lawyers, young hotshots and old lions alike. The Riley Real Estate Firm, the Travel Agency, 10 for City Hall, and the final paper of the morning I sent crashing into the front door of Henry Berlin's men's store. With the last paper nesting against Berlin's doorstep, Charleston ceased to be mine, and I released ownership to the other early risers who had a greater claim on it than I ever would, a boy at ease in darkness. In my 3 years of high school, I had become a familiar, even famous, sight on the early morning streets south of Broad. Later, people told me they could set their watches when I passed their houses before and after first light. All of them knew about the death of my brother, my subsequent breakdown and disappearance, and all would later tell me how they rooted for me during my long penitential season of redemption. When I made my monthly collection runs for their subscriptions, the adults appreciated that I came to their doorsteps in a sports coat, tie, and white shirt, penny loafers impeccably shined. They admired the correctness, if not the stiffness, of my manners, and they appreciated my inarticulate attempts to initiate conversation and that I always brought treats to the families owning cats and dogs. I always remembered the names of these animals. I asked about their kids. They accepted my painful shyness as a kind of initial calling card, but most households remarked that my confidence gradually grew as I grew comfortable approaching their front doors. When it rained, they loved it that I rose an hour earlier to hand-deliver the newspapers to dry porches I was not sure I could reach with my usual toss. They assured me, later, of their certainty that I was well on my way to becoming both a charming and a fascinating young man. But on June 16, 1969, as I rode my bike the two short blocks between Berlin's and the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist, my portrait of myself was of a natural-born loser who at 18 had never been on a date or danced with a girl, nor had a best friend, nor had ever received an A on a report card, nor would ever cleanse his mind of that moment when he discovered his carefree, one-of-a-kind brother in a bath of his own blood. In all the days since that unkillable day, neither my mother or my father, nor any shrink or social worker, nor priest or nun, nor relative or friend of the family, could show me the pathway to a normal productive life with that ghoulish entry visa affixed to my passport. During the rosary for my brother's funeral, I had retreated to the men's room and locked myself into a stall where I wept silently and out of control because the inconsolable nature of my grief seemed selfish in the face of my parents' complete devastation. From that moment, I marked the time when the earth opened up to swallow me whole. I left simple grief on the road behind me and held madness at arm's length as it stormed the walls of my boyhood with its tireless regiments, coming at the most tender parts of my psyche in wave after unappeasable wave. For 3 years, I entered the country of the pit viper. Every dream contained poisonous snakes lying in wait for me, the cottonmouth moccasin coiled against the cypress root, the coral snake beneath the hollowed-out log, the copperhead invisible in a bright carpet of autumn leaves, and the eastern diamondback, with its deadly warning rattle, serving as the lone musician composing the debased libretto of my distress, my fury, and my helpless sadness. The doctors called it a nervous breakdown, terminology I found to be correct. I came apart. Then, with the encouragement of some good people, I put myself together again. The snakes acknowledged my returning health by their silent withdrawal from my dreaming life, and I was never afraid of snakes again, acknowledging that even they had played a necessary role in my recovery. Because I had long feared them with my body and soul, their mordant shapes, their curved fangs, and their venom, they kept my brother's face out of my night world, and I awoke to his permanent residence in my psyche only at daybreak. When I look back, I see that my tragedy was that I could never summon Steve in all his apple-cheeked, athletic good looks and ornamental charm. Once he had died, and I had found him, I could never pull my brother out of that horrible tub. I parked my bike in the rack beside the elementary school and skipped into the back entrance of the cathedral as I did every morning, the entrance that all the insiders knew, from bishop and priests to nuns and altar boys like me. When I opened the door, the smell of the Catholic world washed over me. I walked to the room where Monsignor Maxwell Sadler had almost finished decking himself out in the sumptuous finery of a summer morning mass. Monsignor Max had been a fixture in my family drama since well before I was born. He had taught my parents in their 1938 graduating class at Bishop Ireland High School. He had married my parents, baptized both Steve and me, placed the wafer on my tongue at First Communion. Steve and I were altar boys together when I served my first Mass. When Steve died, the Monsignor hovered about our house, as ubiquitous as my mother's reading chair. When the Bishop of Charleston refused to bury Steve in holy ground, Monsignor Max, Father Max then, worked through the creaky, impenetrable bureaucracy of the pre-Vatican II Church and had Stephen's body exhumed from a public cemetery west of the Ashley and reburied in the sacred ground of St. Mary's Church among my mother's people. I was the cause of ceaseless trouble in those days, and had given up the Catholic faith in a titanic schoolboy's rage, refusing to worship my God or belong to any church. The Catholic Church had rejected the corpse of my brother. Then I entered the realm of child psychiatry and understaffed mental hospitals and yawning tutors as my poor parents tried to mend the broken boy they had on their hands after their favorite son left them. Monsignor Max remained faithful to us in our darkest days and told me that the church was patient and would always be waiting for me to return. It was, and so was he. I watched Monsignor Max comb his hair with flair, making certain that the crease on the left side of his head was as straight as a guy wire. He saw me in his mirror and said, "Leo, my altar boy called in sick. Get in your cassock and surplice. Your mother and father are out there already, and this is your mother's special day, Bloomsday." Of all the elements of my childhood that rang a false note, I was the only kid in the American South whose mother had received a doctorate by writing a perfectly unreadable dissertation on the religious symbolism in James Joyce's equally unreadable Ulysses, which I considered the worst book ever written by anyone. June 16 was the endless day when Leopold Bloom makes his nervous Nelly way, stopping at bars and consorting with whores, and then returning home to his horny wife, Molly, who has a final soliloquy that goes on for what seemed like 6,000 pages when my mother force-fed me the book in 10th grade. Joyce nuts like my mother consider June 16 to be a consecrated mythical day in the Gregorian calendar. She bristled with uncontrollable fury when I threw the book out the window after I had finished it, following an agonizing 6 months of unpleasurable reading. It took me seconds to dress in my surplice and cassock. Then I stood before the radiant, comely Monsignor as he admired his own image in the mirror. Ever since I had known him, I had heard the women of the parish whisper, "What a total waste," when their stylish movie star of a priest floated out toward the altar in all his gallant finery. "Happy Bloomsday, Monsignor Max," I said. "Don't make fun of your mother, young man. Ulysses is her passion, James Joyce the great literary love of her life." "I still think it's weird," I said. "One must always forgive another's passion." "I could forgive her if she hadn't named me Leopold Bloom King, or my brother, Stephen Dedalus King. That's taking it a little far. Have you ever read Ulysses?" "Of course not. He's a flagrant anti-Catholic. I am a Chesterton man myself." I felt an old flush of pride as I led the Monsignor out to the central altar and spotted my parents in the front row, both of them saying the rosary. My father looked up and smiled when he saw me and gave me an exaggerated wink of his right eye, the one my mother could not see. She tolerated playfulness at church not at all. At every Mass, she wore her game face for a crucifixion, as though she were an actual eyewitness to the death of Jesus each time she knelt in her pew. As he faced the small, mostly octogenarian congregation, Monsignor Max began the Mass in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. The words I heard him utter in his operatic voice washed over me like a clean stream from my boyhood, the delicate latticework of memory and language. "I will go to the altar of God." And I went with him and let the ancient, sacrosanct rhythms of the church seize me. When the priest called for water, I provided him with water. When he needed to cleanse his hands for the coming mystery, I emptied cruets over his fingers. When he called for wine, I supplied him with wine in the gold shine of chalices. At the moment of consecration, when he turned the wine into the blood of Christ and the bread into the body of the same God, I rang the bells that had sounded beneath altars for 2,000 years. When I opened my mouth and received the unleavened bread from the consecrated finger and thumb of the priest, I felt the touch of God on my tongue, his taste in my palate, his bloodstream mingling in my own. I had come back to him after a full-pledged, embittered retreat, after he stole my brother from my bedroom and killed him in my bathtub. But I had come back to him, and that is part of my story. After Mass, we headed down to Cleo's restaurant for breakfast, a ritual of summer as ingrained in the texture of our family life as daily Mass. Cleo was a fast-talking Greek girl who ran the cash register as though she were reloading an M16 rifle for snipers. Her patter was endless and profane, until my parents walked in for breakfast, and her attitude turned beatific. Both of my parents had taught her when they were at Bishop Ireland High, and she held fast to the respect that high school kids who never go to college continue to feel for the last teachers of their lives. Even the young waitresses displayed new vigor when my parents appeared in the doorway, and Cleo delivered hand signals to the kitchen staff that translated into hot coffee, orange juice, and ice water on the table. Since I was in training for football season, I ordered 2 eggs over light, grits with red-eye gravy, and 3 slices of bacon. My father would dig into country ham and biscuits with a side order of hash browns. Even though it was the most celebrated day of the year for my mother, she retained the strong-willed discipline that made up every habit of her life. She ordered 1/2 grapefruit and a bowl of oatmeal. My mother admitted to needs, such as nourishment, but not of appetites. "Happy Bloomsday, darling," my father said to my mother, leaning to kiss her on the cheek. "This is your day, and your every wish is our command. Isn't that right, Leo?" "That's right," I said. "We're at your beck and call."
"Very good, Leo," Mother said. "Though you fight me on it, your vocabulary shows constant improvement. Here's your list of 5 words to memorize today."
She handed me a piece of folded-over notebook paper. I made a groaning noise, as I did every morning, and opened the notebook paper to read 5 words that no one would use in normal conversation. Sedulous, perspicacious, ribald, vivisection, and tumid.
"Do you know what any of those words mean?" Mother asked.
"Of course not." I sipped my coffee.
"Did you memorize the 5 I gave you yesterday?"
"Of course."
"Use 2 of the words in a sentence," she commanded.
"I felt a certain need to regurgitate when I cogitated on the works of James Joyce." My father laughed, but the laughter was stifled when my mother cut her pale eyes toward him.
"You heard your father. This is my special day. Bloomsday, a day celebrated all over the world by aficionados of James Joyce."
"The 3 of you ought to get together sometime," I said.
"His admirers are legion," she said,
"even if I walk alone in my own household."
"Leo and I are cooking you a special meal tonight," my father told her.
"The menu is taken directly from the text of Ulysses.
It was Leo's idea."
"Thank you, Leo. That's very thoughtful of you."
"I'm not going to eat it, just cook it," I said.
Although I meant it as a joke, my mother took instant offense. She could freeze me with a gaze that made the dead of winter seem like the best time for planting. From the time I could talk, I heard the men and women of Charleston praise my mother's physical attractiveness, her immaculate grooming, her stylish carriage. I could always see what they were talking about, but could never fully partake in their pleasure over her textured beauty. For me, her prettiness was easy to admire, but difficult to love. Since the death of Steve, she had rarely kissed me. Hugged me, yes, again and again. But kissed me like she used to do when I was a small boy? No. She had taken little pleasure in my childhood, and I could read her disapproval like a page of newsprint whenever she looked at me. We played hard at looking the part of a happy family, and as far as I knew, we succeeded admirably. Only 3 people in the world knew of our deep and hopeless despair in the company of one another. The waitress refilled our coffee cups at the same time. My father's face was baffled and amused and anxious as he witnessed the chilly interplay between me and my mother. He got dizzy with the goofiest kind of love whenever he was with the 2 of us, yet his solicitousness and kindness to me always remained a red flag, an arena of sudden warfare between them. My brother's death had almost killed both my parents, but it did not change my father's fundamental good nature and graceful optimism. He turned his full attention to me and tried to love me harder because I was not Steve. Unlike my mother, who handled his death in the only way she knew how, so I feared that she could never love anyone again who was not Steve. "So," Mother said as she adjusted her lipstick in a compact mirror. That gesture was a signal to the waitress that our breakfast had ended and she was free to clear the dishes. "Your father knows the orders of the day, Leo. I want you to bake 2 dozen chocolate chip cookies for the new neighbors who are moving in today across the street from us, a set of twins, your age exactly, and they'll be your classmates at Peninsula." "Okay, what else?" I asked. "I got a call from Sister Mary Polycarp at the orphanage. They received 2 new orphans from Atlanta, both runaways. They, too, are brother and sister. You will welcome them to Charleston. Then you will bird dog them all year. Watch over them. They've had a terrible life." "They've had great lives. Wait till they spend a year with Polycarp. What a monster. I thought they threw her out of the convent." "Wasn't she the nun who hit that Wallace girl across the eye with a ruler?" Father asked.
"An unfortunate accident," said my mother.
"I was there," I said. "She cut her eyeball, severed the optic nerve, blinded her."
"She's no longer allowed to teach. The order almost expelled her," Mother explained. "In the 3rd grade, she hit so many boys in the face and made so many of us bleed that I nicknamed her the Red Cross." My father chuckled, but was stopped cold by a sudden glitter in Mother's eye.
"Very witty, son," she snapped. "If only some of this wit could translate into solid achievement on your scholastic aptitude test."
"Leo does not test well, darling," my father said.
"But isn't he the life of the party?" she said. "This afternoon, I want you to report to your principal's office and meet your new football coach."
"You are my principal, Mother," I said, "and Coach Ogburn is my football coach."
"He resigned yesterday."
"Why on earth?" Father asked. "He was so close to retirement."
"He refused to coach when he learned his assistant was going to be a black man," my mother said. "So I hired Coach Jefferson from Brooks High as head coach and made him athletic director, too. They're not pussyfooting with integration this year."
"Why do you want me to meet Coach Jefferson?" I asked.
"Because you're his first string center."
"I've always played second string behind Choppy Sargent."
"Choppy and 3 others are following Coach Ogburn to a new segregated academy west of the Ashley. Coach Jefferson wants you to try to keep any other of the white boys on the team from following suit."
I was making a mental list. Chocolate chip cookies, the orphans of Polycarp, Coach Jefferson. "Anything else, Mother?"
"You've got iced tea duty after the hospital workers' march. We'll eat a late dinner."
My mother gave her lipstick a final glance in her mirror and then met my eye evenly.
"Your probation hearing is set for June 26th. You're finally finished with probation."
My father added gratefully,
"Your record is clean, son. You have a clean slate again."
"Not with me, young man," Mother inserted quickly.
"I don't know how you sleep at night after what you put your father and me through."
My father's voice lowered as he said,
"Darling."
"Leo knows what I mean."
Mother did not look up.
"Do you know what she means, Leo?" Father asked.
"He knows," my mother shot back.
"Are you talking about my hatred of James Joyce?" I asked.
"You pretend to hate James Joyce because it's an easier way to say you hate me," she retorted.
"Tell your mother you don't hate her, Leo." Father was a man comfortable with the formulas of scientific law, but lost at sea when it came to engaging the tidal forces of the emotions.
"No, tell her you love her. That's an order."
"I love you, Mother," I said. But even I could measure the perfect note of insincerity I sounded.
"Meet me at my office at 4 this afternoon, Leo," she said. "You have your other tasks for the day."
My parents left the table at the same time, and I watched as my father paid Cleo for the meal. Cleo then came over and sat across from me.
"Here's all the wisdom I got to share, Leo. Being a kid's a pain in the ass. Being an adult is 10 times worse. That's Cleo the Greek, who came from the people who brought you Plato and Socrates and all those other assholes.
Chapter 2 New Friends. After leaving Cleo's, I rang the ivory-white button of St. Jude's Orphanage in the warren of intersecting streets behind the cathedral. Its buzz was irritating and subhuman, insect-like. I associated the orphanage with all things Catholic, from rectories to convents. A huge black man named Clayton Lafayette answered the door and smiled when he saw me. Mr. Lafayette played out a dozen roles at the orphanage, but one was marching the high school kids each day to Peninsula High, a task he performed with military precision and relish. Though his disposition was sunny and affable, his body was brutish.
"Leo the Lion," he said to me.
"Count Lafayette."
We shook hands.
"I've got an appointment to see Sister Mary Polycarp."
"The orphans already call her the Pollywog," he whispered. "She told me your mama was sending you over."
"You be careful around the Pollywog, Count," I whispered back. "She's bad news."
I walked the length of a long corridor of a building designed by a man who held an unbelievable grudge against orphans. It was grim to the point of parody, and the woman who sat behind the government-issue steel desk as I entered her office looked congruent with the spectral glooms of the architecture. Among Roman Catholics of my generation, we play a parlor sport that is mean-spirited and partisan in nature, but guaranteed to elicit laughter and to cause blood to pool in our collective memories. We tell nun stories. We have no shame in it, as any religion that flaunts those plaster of Paris murdered saints in their sanctuaries and crucifix effigies that seem to compete for the most barbarous slaughter of Jesus, the living God, could certainly produce communicants who could invent atrocities for the women of the veil who womped our souls into shape in preparation for eternal life. Some of the nuns of our youth in the 50s and 60s ranked among the finest women we would ever encounter. But the nun with the black heart and the most merciless imagination stamped her brand most indelibly. I once had a nun who stood up her class whenever we heard fire sirens pass our school, then led us in the recitation of the Lord's Prayer that it was not a Catholic home on fire. Another nun would put clothespins on our ears if we acted up in school, and our parents would know by the purple bruises, the dead giveaway, that we had displeased the good sister. Like Eastern Diamondbacks, you could always hear the approach of nuns by the rattling of the sinister beads of their rosaries. In second grade, I had passed a surreptitious note between two boys who were best friends, and the three of us were marched to the front of the room to accept our punishments in full view of the class. Sister Veronica never hit any of her students, but her retaliations were fiendish and inventive. Standing us by the blackboard, she ordered us to hold out our arms like the crucified Christ. In 10 minutes, this punishment seemed benign. But after an hour, Joe McBride burst into tears, his triceps quivering in agony. In contempt, she said to Joe, "Jesus had to hold his arms out on the cross for 3 hours." Joe answered through tears,
"But sister, Jesus had help. He had nails."
And the class howled with helpless, forbidden laughter. That morning at the orphanage, my old fear of nuns formed bile in my throat as I said, "Good morning, Sister Mary Polycarp."
"Hello, Leo. I taught you, didn't I? First or second grade?"
"It was third."
"You were very slow, if I remember correctly."
"That's me, sister."
"But very polite. You can always tell the ones from good families," she said. "I read the papers when you were kicked out of Bishop Ireland."
"Yes, sister. I made a bad mistake."
"Didn't you go to jail or something?"
"No. They put me on probation," I said, uncomfortable with this subject, this situation, and this particular nun.
"I didn't think you were very smart," she said, "but I never thought you would be a convict."
"Probation, not jail, sister."
"Same difference to me."
She studied two files on her desk.
"Did your mother tell you about our big problem?"
"No, sister.
She told me to meet two kids who would be rising seniors and help them make the adjustment to their new high school.
Did she tell you they are both thieves, liars, criminals, and runaways?
Add to my list of complaints, the diocese is sending over 5 colored orphans this afternoon.
No, sister, she didn't tell me any of that.
Since you've spent time in prison and reformed yourself, I thought you might be good for them, lead them in the right direction, so to speak. But I warn you, they're very clever, and both are natural-born liars. They are from the North Carolina mountains, way up in the hills, and there's no kind of white trash like mountain trash. That's a sociological fact. Do you know I've got a master's degree in sociology, Leo?
No, sister, I didn't.
They're in the library waiting for you. Mr. Lafayette will be watching from a distance to make sure there is no trouble, she said.
What kind of trouble could there be? I'm just going to tell them what to expect from the high school.
In the world of orphanages, these two are called long riders because they've run away so often, she informed me. They've been in orphanages from New Orleans to Richmond, Birmingham to Orlando. Long riders are kids looking for something they're never going to find because it doesn't exist in the first place. Their names are Starla and Niles Whitehead. Both are very bright. He's flunked a grade on purpose, but that's because he wanted to be with his sister. I walked down to the library, which lay on the opposite side of the orphanage, where every Christmas my father, dressed as an underweight Santa Claus, handed out gifts to the orphans. It was one of those sad sack libraries overflowing with books that had never been checked out. There was an eerie relationship between the cast-off children and the unopened books, but I was too young to make those kinds of analogies when I entered the huge room to meet Starla and Niles Whitehead. The two of them sat in the rear and looked about as welcoming as scorpions in a bottle, their hostile gazes unnerving me. It surprised me how attractive they were, both with high cheekbones and the fine chiseled features that hinted at a Cherokee bloodline. As I took a chair in front of them, they studied me, the sister with eyes a deep shade of brown that suggested melted chocolate. Uncomfortably, I looked around the room and out the windows at the overrun garden of untended grounds. I cleared my throat and realized my mother had given me no clear directions about why I was meeting with these two hostile strangers.
"Hey," I said at last, "must be great being orphans, ending up in a swell place like this."
Both of them glared at me as though I had not spoken.
"That was sort of meant as a joke," I said. "You know, to break the ice between us."
Again, I was met with those hollowed-out stares. I started over. "Hello, Starla and Niles Whitehead. My name is Leo King. My mother is the principal of your new high school. She wanted me to come over and meet you to see if I could help you. I know it's hard to change schools."
"Nothing I hate worse than a brown, nosing little booger," the girl said. "How about you, brother?"
"They're always the same."
Both spoke in bored, lethargic voices as though I were not in the room to hear.
"But I'm still in hysterics over his orphan joke," she said.
"I was trying to be friendly," I explained. The brother and sister looked at each other and a sneer passed between them.
"Why did you run away from the last orphanage?" I asked.
"For the chance of meeting swell guys like you," Niles said.
"Take the hint, Leo. Isn't that your name? We don't want your help. We'll figure things out on our own," said Starla.
As she brushed a wave of black hair away from her eyes, I noticed the strabismus in her left eye. When she saw me notice it, she shook her head and a curtain of her straight hair half covered the wandering eye again.
"I can help you. I really can," I said.
Niles looked at me with a hard, man-like stare, and I took his measure for the first time. Though he was seated, his physical presence was impressive. He looked a couple of inches over 6 feet tall. His long arms were muscled and veiny, even in repose, but his eyes were bright blue and seemed purloined from a Scandinavian face. The girl was cross-eyed but cute. The stiff face of Niles Whitehead was simply beautiful.
"If you want to know the really good teachers, I can tell you who they are," I said. "If you want to have the easy ones, I know them too."
We want to know when you're going to leave us alone, Niles said. I can see why your parents left you on the orphanage steps, Niles, old boy, I said. He flung himself across the table, his left hand going from my throat. It was only then that I saw that someone had handcuffed the right hands of the orphans to their chairs.
Count! Count Lafayette! I shouted,
and the large man came running through the library door.
Get them out of the handcuffs, I said.
He stiffened and said, Believe me, those two deserve the cuffs, and a lot worse, too.
Go ask Sister Polycarp to uncuff them, I said, or I'm calling my mother. Remind the sister that my mother assigned these kids to me as a project because I have to complete 300 hours of community service. She won't like it that they're handcuffed to their chairs.
The mention of my mother's name struck the right chord of terror in the hearts of most Charlestonians.
You handcuff criminals. They're going to be my high school classmates, I continued. Besides, they promised me they wouldn't run away if you took off the cuffs.
They did?
Mr. Lafayette eyed the boy and girl with suspicion, and it was clear that he liked neither one of them.
We just made an agreement, and they gave me their word of honor.
Tell him, I said to them.
Yeah, boy, Mr. Lafayette said to Niles. You made that promise?
Sure did, Niles said.
Wait here. I'll go ask Sister Polycarp, he said while walking toward the main door.
I turned and leaned across the table, talking fast.
I can help you two fruitcakes if you'll let me. You don't want my help, tell me now, and I'm out of here.
The brother turned to the sister, and I watched them pass information back and forth with a wordless intensity.
Starla said, We've got to get through this year, Niles, then we're free to walk out of orphanages forever.
Her dark hair fell away from her face, and her gaze softened her brother's fury.
Tell us what to do, Leo, said Niles.
Promise me you won't run away.
Right now, fast, and mean it.
We promise, both of them said. Polycarp is mean, I said in a whisper. A sadist and a psychopath. Learn to say, yes, sister, no, sister. Yes, sir, no, sir, to the count. He's a sweetheart. Get him on your side. Get those snotty looks off your faces. Try to smile once a year. You can work this place.
How do you know all this? Starla asked.
When my brother died, I didn't handle it well, so I was in a mental hospital for a couple of years. Had to figure out a plan to get out.
Then you ain't no better off than us, numbnuts, Niles said.
I ain't handcuffed to no chair, hillbilly, I said. Why are you wearing those ugly jumpsuits?
They've got the word orphan stenciled on the back, Niles answered. Sister had them specially made for us, because we're runaways.
Why do you keep running away?
We've got a mama and a grandma. They're looking for us, Starla said.
How do you know?
Because we'd kill ourselves if we thought they weren't, Niles said.
Behind me, I heard the oak door swing open, and I turned to see Mr. Lafayette walking toward us with a set of keys in his hand. He walked around the table and unlocked Starla's handcuffs first, and then Niles's. Both of them rubbed their sore wrists. Mr. Lafayette possessed a sunny disposition, but he looked careworn and harried as he addressed me.
I'll get fired, Leo, if these kids run away. I can't lose this job.
Mr. Lafayette has four children, I told Niles and Starla.
Is your wife still on dialysis? I asked him.
Yeah, she's not well.
We're not going to run away, Mr. Lafayette, Starla said.
Speak for yourself, her brother said.
Shut up, Niles. I speak for my brother, too. We won't cost you your job, Mr. Lafayette.
I'll watch out for you two, Mr. Lafayette said, looking back toward the library entrance. I can help you in a million ways.
He then walked back toward the main hall. When I got up to leave, Starla White had surprised me by saying,
Hey, Four Eyes. Didn't anyone tell you how ugly your glasses are? They make your eyes look like two busted bungholes.
I blushed deeply, the blood rushing up to my face, soon to be followed by a blotchiness that would make my appearance all the more comical. I had inherited my father's shyness, his chalky paleness, and his tendency to redden from throat to crown when he was caught off guard. I learned the harsh lessons of being unattractive very early in my career as a child, but I never grew accustomed to it being highlighted or laughed at by my peers. But now I surprised even myself by tearing up, the most infantile and unwarranted reaction I could think of and not the course I would have chosen in front of these newcomers to my life. I wanted to run and hide from my own face. Then Starla surprised me by bursting into tears herself, crying hard, realizing the damage she had inflicted on me. It was the first time I think she truly saw me.
"I'm so sorry, Leo. So sorry. I do it every time. I can't help it. I do it every time someone's nice to me. I say something hurtful, something no one can forgive, something bad, evil. I don't trust it when someone's nice to me, so I say something to make them hate me. Tell him, Niles. I always do it, don't I?"
"She always does it, Leo," Niles agreed. "She doesn't mean it."
"Look," she said, pulling her long hair away from her eyes. "Look at my left eye. What a cross-eyed bitch. Look, what an ugly, cross-eyed jerk bitch I am. It was because you were nice. But if you hadn't been nice, I would have said it anyway. It's what I am,"
she added helplessly, with a shrug, as if she couldn't properly explain. I took off my glasses and wiped them with a handkerchief. Then I dabbed at my eyes and tried to compose myself. Putting my glasses back on, I said to Starla, "I know an eye surgeon, the best in the city. I'll ask him to take a look at your eye. Maybe he can do something."
"Why would he look at her eye?"
Niles said, protective of his sister.
"She doesn't got a penny."
"Have," his sister corrected. "Quit talking redneck. She doesn't have a penny."
"He's a wonderful man, this doctor," I told them.
"How do you know him, big shot?" Niles asked.
"Because I'm a paper boy, and I know everybody on my route."
I glanced at my watch, and with my mother's list in mind, stood and told them in farewell,
"I have to go, but I'll get my father to invite you for dinner, okay? I'll call you about the time."
Both of them looked frankly astonished at something as simple as an invitation to dinner. Niles glanced uneasily at his sister, who offered as I turned,
"And Leo, I'm sorry about what I said. I really am."
"I said something mean to my mother today," I admitted, "so I deserved it. It was God getting me back."
"Leo?" Niles said.
"Yeah, Niles."
"Thanks for this."
He held up his wrist.
"When we met you, we were in handcuffs. When you're leaving, we're not. My sister and I won't forget it."
"We'll remember it for the rest of our lives," she said.
"Why?" I asked.
"Because," Niles said, "no one's ever nice to us."